everyone, I'm Dr. Lucy Mackay. I'm the CEO of a charity called Medics for Rare Diseases, and I'm joined by my colleague Kim today.
Hello everybody, I'm Kim Winter. I'm a psychotherapist and I'm the CEO and clinical director at Rare Minds, and Rare Minds provides counselling and wellbeing services in the UK for those with rare genetic and undiagnosed conditions. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, well, it's always great to have a chat with you, Kim. We've come together today because we're actually meeting up in Brussels in May for the European Conference on Rare Diseases by EURORDIS. We're really excited to be there. We're going to be talking in a session called No Health Without Mental Health on the 15th of May at 2 o'clock. We're going to be talking about what do we mean by mental health and supporting mental health in rare conditions with people living with rare conditions and the rare community, and also what does psychologically informed care mean and what should we really be aiming for, both as advocates but also asking policymakers and healthcare systems to meet the needs of people living with rare conditions, their carers and families. So Kim, mental health and rare disease, they're quite intertwined, aren't they? Can you break it up for us a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important time for rare conditions, Lucy, where we have a really interesting opportunity to integrate mental health into rare disease care in a way that's, as we've always talked about it, been the missing piece. And I think there is current will and impetus to make a really significant change in that regard. And rare conditions have a really unique opportunity in that they can learn from other sectors such as cancer and sort of long-term conditions. What are they doing well? What are they not doing so well? And in terms of bringing mental health into a more integrated and holistic treatment model for living as well as possible with really rare conditions. We've talked before about the frustrations we have that some of the stresses on mental health are intrinsic to living with the condition. You know, they are common across a lot of conditions, the multiple uncertainties you have to deal with around how it's going to impact you over time or life expectancy or whether it's going to be a good or bad day for symptoms. But also things that interface with the healthcare system itself. Is the doctor I'm seeing today going to understand my condition? Are they going to be aware of how medications I may already be on might interface with other conditions I'm living with? But that in our services, there are already things that we see are common stressors to living with rare conditions around that isolation, around the long journey to diagnosis, and then its impact on how you feel about engaging with healthcare services going forward, and the reduced trust you might have if you've had your symptoms dismissed or misunderstood or minimized in some way. Is someone going to have heard of my condition? Are they going to be aware of how it impacts me? And that's not just with healthcare professionals, that's with those that you bump into every day too, you know, the public or your employers or those in a school setting. We know that when you have a more common condition, people lean in, people, you know, go, oh my goodness, how can I help? You know, that sounds really stressful. With rare conditions, often people lean out because terms or words or diagnoses are unfamiliar, and people tend to lean out or worry about saying the wrong thing or just don't understand really in the same way. And then, of course, as we've talked about at length, the whole sort of intergenerational impact, and particularly with the genetic conditions, how that can transfer down generations. And as we've talked about before, be sometimes a little bit like a sort of a small bomb going off in a family when you're diagnosed with a condition, and how that diagnosis is delivered and how impactful that can be on mental health. Not just in that moment, but in terms of setting the trajectory in relationship with that condition going forward too. So there's an awful lot. And I think where it's really helpful, where you and I are talking together, is, you know, we often say that physical health and mental health have to stand together. They have to be integrated. Those old divides between services and sectors have to fall away. And I think this is where the rare disease community has a real opportunity to challenge those old divides. And that's partly what we're talking about, and partly what is going to be really helpful in the ECRD session, really, knowing what we can ask of healthcare professionals and services, to think more closely about what is the really fundamental and important role of rare disease communities and the tremendous part they play, bringing all their expertise and lived experience to the table, but also what communities can realistically offer and provide within their remit, and what we have to, I think, become more, militant's not quite the right word, but, you know, become more sort of advocating for what is needed from healthcare professionals and services to mitigate and avoid those stresses that we know are caused by poor interactions with healthcare professionals or services that don't function well enough and understand rare conditions themselves. Does that resonate with some of your thinking too?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. You know, technically within my family, the rare condition died with my brother. I'm not a carrier of it. So, you know, according to healthcare, we're not a rare disease family, but that bond that goes off inside a family, I know all too well. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this podcast here today.
I think that's a really important point, Lucy, because, you know, rare disease advocacy organisations, everyone here listening to this will be expert at knowing where the gaps are and where the unmet needs are, and will have a natural impulse to want to step into that space, because that's what we do in the rare disease sector. So we go, yeah, I'll do it. And I think this is a really interesting point to kind of pause and say, what do we need to be doing as collective and individual rare disease organisations, and what do we need to be leaning into asking more of from health and social care services? And I say, no, wait, stop right there. Because actually the very fact that you exist in the world at all is a really fundamental baseline level of supporting the mental health and well-being of your communities, that anyone out in the world can reach out to your organisation and know that they will speak to someone or have access to resources that understands something of that condition. And that in and of itself has a tremendous, powerful impact on mitigating mental health impact.
So anyone who is listening to this, just by doing the work you are doing,
yeah,
you are providing hope, you are providing a part of that mental health support. I really, really urge people to not lose sight of that, because then you're not taking the reward that you should, and that also drives positive feelings and gives one a sense of worth, being worthwhile and feeling less helpless. And although that now with the internet and greater globalization, there's lots of these groups, it doesn't mean they're any less worthwhile and vital than they were in the 80s and beyond, before that. And I think that's really key for me when we're talking about supporting mental health and living healthily, is it isn't a service. It's not one service.
And we talk about this a lot, don't we, that mental health support is not one thing. It is about thinking about many different types of support and utilising what is already in existence, upskilling and informing those who are working in those services or those groups, but also looking at what you're already doing in your existing communities that is probably in and of itself has mental health and support and well-being function. That includes things like, you know, do you have Facebook forums? Do you have mentoring systems? You know, it will look different according to your particular organisation and your particular demographic. You know, there's going to be very different needs in an organisation which supports mainly those, say, with a condition that impacts in middle age and then is neurodegenerative over time, to another organisation that perhaps supports mainly parents, perhaps with younger children who are impacted by a condition. So it's back to this idea that mental health support is not one thing and one size does not fit all. So it's really interesting to look at what other people are doing in this sector. You know, what sort of ideas have you got? What sort of programmes are you running? What do you do already? But I think it's also really important not to get overwhelmed and to start sort of jumping too quickly into we should be doing this, we should be doing that. You know, sort of start with, well, what are we doing already? Giving yourself a pat on the back for that, you know, even if it's, I was going to say just the fact you exist, you know, that's a huge achievement in it.
Yeah, that's the biggest achievement.
Yeah, that's massive. You know, the fact that you are a group, you've come together, you exist in the world is massive. And then moving out from there, really, because the last thing that I think we want for rare disease organisations, because leaders are so passionate, because they have such experience, it's very easy to become burnt out and to start feeling you've got to meet those gaps and needs, as we talked earlier, off your own bat. You know, rare disease people are very good for going, fine, I'll do it then. And I think we need to be careful about mental health, that what is it that you can do as a rare disease organisation with your existing resources and expertise? What are you doing already? And where might you need to join up, or where can we join up as a whole to sort of inform and put pressure on services, but also encourage healthcare professionals themselves to think creatively and laterally about mental health, to just have mental health in the picture when they're speaking to individuals and families in their consulting rooms. And that means both how healthcare professionals interact, but it also means encouraging physical healthcare services, if we put it like that, medical services, to start having more of a dialogue with mental health services in their own right. I was talking to some colleagues recently about, you know, do you have any awareness of rare conditions? No. What are you talking about? Now, that the mental health sector in itself in the UK, which is the one that I'm most familiar with, has very little understanding or awareness of rare conditions. So there's a whole world, there's a whole professional body skill set out there who are needing to be trained, upskilled and aware of the mental health impact of rare conditions, because otherwise they are going to be running services, designing interventions that are not so fit for purpose, really. But things can be easily adapted with sometimes very little education. You know, I've just done a conversation with one of the professional bodies in for psychotherapy in the UK. What are the six things that you really need mental health care professionals to know about rare conditions? So just as we are leaning mental health into the rare disease space, we also need to lean rare disease into the mental health space. And there are resources and there are existing services there that can be upskilled and uptrained, if that's a word. It's really useful to remember that there, you know, there is a vast mental health workforce out there. We know it's under pressure, we know waiting lists are long, we know it's beleaguered in all sorts of ways, but actually there are often existing services, individuals and programs that are already out there in existence that with greater understanding of the impact of rare can be adapted, can be utilised, can be very supportive to the community and healthcare professionals too. You know, we have everything from family therapists, couples therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, group programmes. There is a very wide range of support out there. And not everyone is going to gravitate towards the same sort of support at the same time. And this is something I think we really need to be aware of when we're thinking about rare conditions and mental health. I'm quite averse to the idea of sort of generic programs that we sort of put people through in order to sort of support your mental health. This is about thinking with individuals. You know, we go back to that idea that rare conditions impact individuals. You know, and there may be generic features across rare conditions, but they are often expressed very differently across families or in any one person. And that is the same with mental health impact. You know, what one person will manage and cope with, another will find more difficult or more frustrating. And the context in which you are living and the other aspects of your life will also impact how well you are able to, say, sort of surf the impact of living with and being diagnosed with a rare condition.
I think there's a lot more dialogue about this. And the great thing about dialogue means you get more language, and that becomes easier and easier to talk and have those tools to be able to communicate and work with people, understand them and help them. And something that is really important in the work, I think, of rare disease is being mindful of intersectionalities. So this is a concept that was defined by Kimberley Crenshaw, and it's around how different aspects of someone can cause advantage or disadvantage in society. So you might have a social or health inequality in your experiences because you're living in poverty, for example, and you can't get to your appointments. But then you might also have an inequality based on the language you speak or your race within that environment. Yeah. And that all of these different factors can build up to mean that some people in certain situations are at a much greater disadvantage than others. And then, so you have this going on in society all the time, that we're not all on an even playing field when it comes to living in the world it is today, particularly within healthcare. And then if you add the complexity of another identity, which is living with a rare disease, where you might not have much information, there might not be research, there might not be treatment, you might have had a really stressful and traumatic journey to diagnosis, your services might be few and far between or far away or non-existent. That then is another aspect where you're facing challenges, and that all of these challenges build up so that one person with the same apparent profile of needs has a much more difficult time getting those needs met.
I completely agree. And I think both physical and mental health care services have not been good at addressing, observing and understanding the intersectional compounding factors on mental health and well-being. And I think, again, rare disease community has a really good opportunity to build that thinking in to when we're talking about mental health and well-being for both our individual organisations and services, but at the wider generic level too. And I think this is where I feel very positive and very enthusiastic about the inroads being made into mental health and rare conditions, because it has been a little bit left behind. It has been the missing piece, but actually we have some advantage about being able to learn from what has not happened before and build that in from the outset.
But also, Kim, if you don't mind me saying, the other thing about rare is you've got to be scrappy. That's what you have to do when you're represented. But also, very few rare conditions really fit into one healthcare bucket or one need.
Yeah.
And so we can bring mental health in all the time because we're having to say, no, this condition needs support with this many different body systems or this many different aspects of their care or this many different aspects of access. Yeah. So, you've got that opportunity because even if we're only thinking about physical health at all, you've still got to be very diverse in how you are supported, because most rare conditions are multi-system or change or are lifelong and change over time, or people transition from childhood to adulthood services. So you've already got to have a multidisciplinary team and a holistic approach to supporting families and patients and carers. So bring mental health with it.
And I think this is again the nuance of not just saying, for example, when we're thinking about multidisciplinary teams, yes, it would be fantastic if there was a psychologist or a psychotherapist attached to every MDT as a matter of course. But it's beyond that. It's about thinking, every healthcare professional who's involved in an MDT, thinking about the mental health aspects of that individual in front of them. And when I say that individual in front of them, I mean that very specifically, because the needs of someone who is, you know, a middle-aged white woman is going to be very different to the needs of a young black man. You know, there's sort of, it's about thinking holistically in context, how is how I'm speaking to, supporting and working with this person, what are their unique and specific needs. Now, sometimes we can think, well, that's a big job, isn't it? No, I don't think it is. I think that's just about thinking empathically, creatively, and, you know, thinking about who is the person you are with in this particular moment and what are their needs at this particular moment in time. Because, of course, our mental health and well-being fluctuates over time too. You know, what we might need at one point in life might be very different to what we need at another point. You know, I'm talking to a young couple at the moment who are going through a very arduous process of, and it's really impacting their relationship. They've been living with the condition as part of their life for a long time, but it's coming up in a very different way as they are approaching having their own children in a way that they don't want to have them in an ideal world. And the stress and strain that's putting on their relationship and on that, you know, particularly the person who is carrying the gene that they are hoping to eradicate at this point. So, you know, we need different things at different times, and for healthcare professionals to be holding that in mind when they are in consultations with families and individuals, I think is just so key.
I think bringing it back then to the audience that we're talking to and patient advocacy groups is about how you within your frame, what you can do, and knowing when it's outside of your box. And I think one of the things as a second generation advocate that I find quite frustrating is a lot of the needs of people living with rare conditions that in when they're not met are predictable.
Mm-hmm.
They are profoundly predictable. I know all the different conditions are different. I'm not saying we're not individuals. I'm not saying all conditions are the same, but just like when a person embarks on starting a family,
yeah,
there are predictable things that might come up. That's an adventure in itself, that, you know, changes dynamics and et cetera. The minute you even start thinking about starting a family, you're a fairly unique path, but there are predictable things in which to support someone.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where I think we can really, as a community, just write it out in black and white. I love this whole idea of six things that healthcare professionals need to know, or mental health care professionals need to know about rare disease, because let's make sure we're not getting the predictable stuff that can be mitigated. We're not leaving that. So I think, you know, a lot of that is around language, communication. Things are still said about rare and genetic conditions, terms and words are still said. I've sort of learned from the anti-racism movement around microaggressions, when people say harmful things or do harmful things that mount up and mount up, and they seem small as an individual thing, but over time they really erode someone's self-confidence, their confidence about their place in society, erode their respect and things like that. And you see this in rare. So what gets said to people, so things like there's nothing we can do.
Yeah,
that just, what a sentence. It's so easy to say, so hard to take back, and its implications are massive. Yeah. And so this is where I think we can really get the patient advocacy groups working, is on their own tools. In this session, we'll be talking about creating a mentally healthy toolkit.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting observation around the microaggressions that those with rare conditions are on the receiving end of all day. One of the things that we hear a lot in our services is the distress when you're told something like, you shouldn't be feeling like that. And it's sort of, where does that leave someone who may be feeling very unwell, or very sort of even emotionally unwell? They sort of can't make sense of the symptoms they're experiencing. they're in pain, they're in distress, the blood tests are run or tested on someone, we have, you know, you shouldn't be feeling like this. There's nowhere to go when you're told that.
Yeah, the denial of experiences, for
yes,
example.
It's devastating. So even sort of the education of healthcare professionals to sort of flip that around, say, we're not clear at present why you're feeling like this, but let's try and see how we can help you manage that or think about it further. That's a very different expression to you shouldn't be feeling like this. And I think it's not that it's any one phrase or term, but it's when these, it's like any microaggression, when they build up over time, it's so corrosive to mental health and well-being and your sense of safety in the world, actually, which is something I think we don't always talk about enough within rare disease communities. You know, your sense of safety within the healthcare services. Will I be understood, treated with respect? And is there parity of care with more common conditions? You know, we're still a little bit of a way to go, I think.
Yeah. But Kim, like you said, but this isn't just in healthcare, this is in society. And I will share this story blindly because I can't see the people who are listening to it, so that makes it easier. But I remember growing up and always just having to say, I was taught to say that, to not forget my brother who died before I was born. So I was taught to say that he died. And the adults, when I was a child, used to sort of look like deer in headlights and couldn't cope with it. And I learned as a child, it's easier to just then say, it's okay, he had a genetic condition. And they would say, oh, okay then. And what that taught me was it was okay that he died because he had a genetic condition.
It sort of makes it all right for other people.
Exactly. What it's done is it's helped them keep their optimism that these bad things don't happen, or if they do happen, they only happen to certain people. And I think that that it's so ingrained in society. So I think there's also this is that, like, we've been talking about healthcare professionals, but this is a societal problem. And, you know, that's a larger conversation, I think, about how we get to the roots of this, of these ideas that mean that we do find that people with rare genetic conditions, people living with disability, people with long-term conditions do get dismissed.
Yeah.
And then what people feel is they feel less worthy. Mm. But actually, that's not a wrong feeling. That is what they are being told by society, by healthcare, because if you were worthy, someone would be doing something about this. And I think, therefore, I think when we're thinking about this, any kind of mental health support or toolkit, it's that keeping in mind that simple things do really help. And coming back to those, what's predictable and what is fairly solvable? You know, is it that we think about our language? Is it that we think about when someone might most need a call? Or is it to do with, actually, things would be a lot easier if I could just get to a yoga class, or if I could afford a mental health meditation app. But those things are going to be different for different people. Exactly. So just because it works for you, it doesn't mean it's going to work for someone else. But their needs might be really simple. It's just something you haven't thought about. But that one measure might make a whole difference.
And I think this is where it's going to be really interesting in the session at ECRD, Lucy, to see what the communities bring is, you know, we have a sense now of what some of the common themes are, but to kind of, it's really important to reinforce those back to ourselves to say, yes, I live with this condition, that's very different to yours, but we're seeing the same difficulties across the conditions we're all living with. How can we address those collectively? But also, how can you, and what are the difficulties that are unique and specific to your condition? And what are the ways in which you might begin to start addressing those as a community and an organization? So thinking, you know, we often talk in Rare Minds about thinking generically and thinking specifically. in terms of mental health impact and mental health support. And I think that's the model we need to be taking into the ECRD session. You know, what is generic and what is specific? But the other thing I would also say is start where you are. You know, sometimes I talk to patient leaders, and one of the things we really don't want as we start thinking about mental health and well-being, for it to become a stress on organizations or leaders in its own right. You know, start where you are, go back to that principle, we exist, that's fundamental. Then start to be thinking in a wider sense of, well, what is there out there? What isn't out there? What can we start to inform in terms of, you know, healthcare professionals and what they need to know generically and specifically? How do we work together as rare disease organizations? And what can I take forward in from my own particular condition specific perspective? Then I think we're starting to do something really interesting as a wider community. And I think, you know, it's a very positive time.
I do too. I love that. I completely agree that this is an exciting time. And I think it's an opportunity for us to bring everyone on board. And I think my challenge is when we go about thinking about mental health and the future of rare diseases, who's not in the room? Who can't you see? Who doesn't have a voice? And you might not be able to get them in the room or give them a voice. That might not be possible to get them to express themselves, but make sure you've asked, involved them, and be their advocate, because otherwise we will leave people behind as well. And there's no need. There's absolutely no need. If we can really embrace being a whole community with our general needs and our specific needs, then I think it's an opportunity for us to show other areas of policy, other areas of health, that you can bring everyone with you. Everyone can have a piece of the pie and be looked after if we, you know, work together and really try to understand where our commonalities are, but also where people might have a specific need.
I think that's a good place to end, Lucy.
Shall we? Yeah. Obviously, we'll be at ECRD in Brussels in May, and we would love to speak to people. This session, No Health Without Mental Health, has actually been made an official event under European Mental Health Week, which is really fantastic. And so it's great that you are listening. We're really grateful for it. We hope we see you at the session and look forward to all the work that is going to come out of this that will make a tangible difference to people's lives who are impacted with rare conditions. See you there.